How the college admissions process is changing and what's important for parents and students to understand. If you applied to college as a high school senior, chances are it wasn't a terribly complicated process. You probably filled out somewhere between 1 and 3 applications, wrote some essays, sent them in, and found out in the spring whether or not you'd gotten into your favorite school. A fat envelope was usually good news, a skinny envelope, a rejection. If you're the parent of a high school senior or a recent college applicant, you know that everything has changed. Maybe there were 10 or 20 applications. Surely you used the Common App. You filled out a FAFSA and a CSS. Maybe you even hired an independent college consultant to help you navigate the system. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about the college admissions process from experts in the thick of it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. And from the MPBN studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. This is an anxious time for many high school seniors. Within a few weeks, they will find out which colleges they did and didn't get accepted to. For high school sophomores and juniors, thoughts of applying to college may not be top of mind, but maybe should be. Joining me in our Augusta studio to share their thoughts on the best strategies for choosing a college, Ann Richardson. She's Director of College Counseling at Kent Hill School and past president of the New England Association for College Admission Counseling. Jared Cash is Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Maine, Farmington. And Myla Tappan is College Access and Outreach Manager for the Finance Authority of Maine. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What questions do you have about getting ready to apply for college? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet, if you so wish, at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And I'm going to start with you. We were chatting before the program that you've been a college counselor for 18 years. How much has the whole process changed in that time?
Well, the process has changed enormously. Certainly, it is not the process that you or I went through way long time ago. But what I see happening is that the whole process has become much earlier. I think that students need to start thinking about the college process much earlier. Students are applying to college much earlier in the senior year. They're hearing from colleges much earlier. And all of this means that there needs to be some significant preparation in the sophomore and junior years, both in terms of courses taken, tests that need to be taken, using one's summers wisely, getting involved in different activities and clubs and jobs as students need to do that. I think the costs have changed, the costs have gone up, and it has become a really nervous time for parents contemplating sending kids to college. And then I would say also that the spectrum has become much wider. I think students are looking far away for colleges as well as in-state. They're thinking about going abroad. We also have many more international students applying to colleges in the United States, and that's kind of changing the numbers. So I think there's the process is definitely different.
Jared, I'm going to turn to you. One of the things that Ann mentioned is that the process is earlier. I know Bates College is one of the colleges that has University of Maine Farmington, you used to work at Bates, has an early action program. I'm going to ask you if you could step back a little bit, explain the difference between early action and early decision, and then what you're seeing in terms of those kinds of decisions kids are making.
Sure. Early action is different than early decision in the way that it's not binding, and it's not a binding contract. Early decision is. And so early action is a way at most schools, it can be defined a little bit different each place, but for the most part, early action is a process where you apply early. It means by November 15th at our institution. I don't believe you can apply by policy before October 1. It might be a little later.
I think it's September 15th.
September 15th
now.
Wow, it's going earlier. Different schools have early action, early decision deadlines. Early decision, what you're saying to the college is, if I'm admitted, I'll withdraw all applications, and you sign a contract saying you will so. One thing I do like, though, that I think about early decision contracts, sometimes they can be painted, I think, too starkly with a dark brush, is they have usually a pending agreement that it has, the school needs to meet financial, your financial need. And so I do think most of those schools with those types of agreements, early decision, do a pretty good job in meeting financial aid need.
And early action and early decision are much more popular than they used to be.
Absolutely. I mean, at Farmington this year, our early action pool was 43% larger than last year.
In 1 year, 43% larger.
In 1 year. And so that that is starting to hit the main landscape, is what I would say. I ducked out of higher ed enrollment for about 4 years, and when I came back, college nights were no longer being offered in November for high school seniors in Maine, but they're being offered earlier, and these early action processes are taking off. That used to be something I certainly recall seeing nationwide, and we strategically, in my Bates days, would hold off on our Maine open house dates till last, just because the students weren't quite engaged in the process yet. But that's changed dramatically and quickly.
Miley, I want to bring you into the conversation. I almost don't even know where to start, but let's start when your kids are young. What I heard when my kids were growing up is a whole lot of different messages. But one of the many messages is don't even bother saving for college because it's going to end up counting against you when you fill out the FAFSA in other forms.
That is probably the biggest myth I would want to debunk today. Saving for college is a very, very good, positive thing to do. The reality is that when people fill out the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid that all seniors in high school should be completing every single year they're looking at going to school, the FAFSA excludes many assets altogether. Even those assets that they do include are counted at a very minimal rate, never more than 5.64%. But most of our families here in Maine don't have to provide any asset information at all on the FAFSA. So saving for college is an excellent idea. It provides additional options so that if you have the school that you're really wanting to go to, but maybe they don't provide quite enough financial aid, that's how families are going to make up the difference. And that's a very wise thing to do. So we absolutely encourage families to save, and we have some great programs to help families get started.
Most colleges ask for the FAFSA, and I don't know the acronyms completely, but I know federal and aid are in it. But there's also something called the CSS that some colleges require and some do not. What is that?
So the FAFSA, like you said, is the free application for federal student aid, and all schools have to use that to award their federal financial aid funds. And in Maine, that's how we award the Maine State Grant as well. But then you've got some other schools out there, think Bates, Bowdoin, Colby, that have a tremendous amount of their own institutional financial aid dollars. And so the FAFSA has become easier over the years, meaning that it asks fewer questions. Well, when the schools are awarding their own money, they want to know more about a family. So they require a form, often in the Northeast, it's the CSS profile, and it is more detailed. Where the FAFSA can be done in about 25 minutes, I really recommend taking about 2 to 3 hours to set aside to do the profile. It's going to ask many more in-depth questions about the family's financial situation, because those schools want to be sure that they're doing a good job awarding their funds and giving it to the students who need those funds the most.
All right. Going back to you, Ann, I want to go back to the broad question. How do you recommend that students even think about choosing college? Do you recommend the safety school, the reach school, the perfect fit school? How many applications do you recommend? You know, so many of us in our generation applied to 1, 2, 3 colleges, typed up that application, sent it off in the mail with a stamp, and that was that. With the Common App, it's so much easier to apply to many, many colleges. How many is too many, and how do you even think about it? How do you get your head around it?
It's important to apply to a broad spectrum of colleges, particularly if finances are going to be an issue for families. We always recommend in our office that students apply to a couple of reaches. I think that every student needs to be ambitious and reach high if that's what he or she wants. We also want to we also counsel students to apply to colleges where they are going to be at the top of the pool, and that may open up some merit aid possibilities for them, that and also some honors programs and other opportunities like internships that might not be available where they lower down in the pool. I think today it's really important to have lots of conversations with students about the kind of school that they're looking for, whether they're looking for a big school, whether they're looking for a small school. Students at Kent's Hill often will come in and say, I'm looking at a big school because Kent's Hill is a fairly small school, but anything is going to be bigger than Kent's Hill, I say to them. And most of the time, what that conversation becomes is, in what kind of situation do you learn the best? Do you learn the best in small classes, in big classes, in lecture classes, in discussion-based classes? And that way you can, as a counselor, one can really begin to think of schools and think of a list where students are going to be at their most successful. And that ultimately is the whole point of this process, is to find the right fit for students, to find a place where they are going to find success in college, and whether that's a big school down south or a small school in Maine, it's the right fit that's really important. So that's really the conversations that we start with. I would also say that visiting schools is absolutely essential, particularly if you have a student who is not that engaged in the process yet, who's not really, the parents are thinking about college, but the student is not thinking about college yet. And often just stepping onto a campus and the student is looking around and saying, gosh, you know, yeah, I could really do this. I really can see myself belonging here. That's a great way to kind of kickstart the process for students who are not quite engaged yet.
Jared, let's look at this from the college's point of view, though. I know of students who have applied to 24 schools, and I don't think that's very uncommon anymore. What does that do for colleges when they're trying to figure out, the admissions offices, trying to figure out how many students to admit every year so that they fill the first year dorms, but they don't have a problem? You know, that this is changing so rapidly every year.
Well, we're really good with numbers, first of all. Enrollment folks are just knee deep in enrollment reports and numbers. And so we're pretty good at actually projecting out what admit rate we need. How many of those students that we admit will accept the offer and matriculate into the class. And so there's a bit of a science to that part. But it depends on the institution. Some are look at the process in a way that mirrors what Anne is talking about. We want to fit as well. And I know that's the case for the institutions I've worked for. I know it's what we communicate aggressively at Farmington, is that this is about a mutual process.
What does that mean? Because if you're a high school junior or senior going on college tours and the college admissions officer who's giving the lecture says, we're looking for a fit, the kid thinks, what on earth does that mean?
We want to build the class once. And so we want you here for all 4 years. And so if you leave today, it's okay if your gut feeling isn't there. If you heard something that didn't click for you, apply to another school. There are 3,000 colleges and universities in the United States. There's actually more than that now. And I think this is a market as of late where there's an oversaturation of supply. And so our students, especially in the Northeast, have a huge advantage. So it is about, I always say, when I'm helping a friend, a family friend with their son or daughter, I always say, don't apply to a school that in the end, if that's the only school you get into, you wouldn't go there. Mm-hmm. There's that many schools and colleges to choose from that your goal should be by May 1, when you need to make a deposit, to just one school in the end. That if you just got into one of your 5 schools or 3 schools, I'm going to go for a little bit more of a conservative number, you should be happy. You should have done enough research and figured out the fit well enough that you can't wait to unpack your bags 3 or 4 months later. So the fit process, I think, is taking off. I think even the elites the Ivy Leagues and some others who have had years of sharpening their pencils on the numbers as far as SAT and GPA, they're even saying, hey, enough is enough. We need a more well-rounded student. We need someone who understands our ethos, who's a good fit here, who's going to make our community fun and happy and engaged. And I think, honestly, the higher ed does these pendulum swings on this whole topic. At times they go into, we need the best profile. We need to be able to climb the rankings. And then they go through learning lessons where students are depressed in college, or they're transferring out, or they're dealing with really tough things and they don't feel that fit. And the national trend right now is students are actually not just transferring once, but they're transferring twice.
Really?
That's actually the plurality as far as the amount of students who are finishing a degree. Not for the elites, not for the really strong universities, and both public and private, those tend to still have a pretty strong four-year degree completion rate. But if you look at the 70% of the other students nationwide, the mass majority, they're actually picking up the baton a couple times in order to finish their degree.
Mm. And Myla, what about financially? I've heard that you should not assume that the public school will be the least expensive for your family. Explain that, because the sticker price can be $60,000 or higher for many private schools.
Right. That's one of the things we like to talk with families about, is that at the end of the day, we want students to be at the right school for them so they can be successful. And we don't want them to automatically say, hey, that school that's $60,000 is financially out of reach. The reality is some of the most expensive schools also have the absolute best financial aid. So every year I see students who are getting award letters who are actually finding that some of those expensive schools are indeed the most affordable for them. Now, there's a great tool that became available about 4 years ago. It's called a net price calculator. The federal government requires that all schools have this available. It's just a tool, but what it allows families to do is to go in and put in their specific information, and the school will use their specific information as well. And what a student will receive at the end of that, and it's a very quick 5, 10, 15 minute process maybe, they will receive an estimate of what it looks like that student might be eligible to receive. Now, I would never want a student to make a decision based on net price calculator. Some schools are much better than others. But what it does show families sometimes is that you can't just look at the cost of the school. It's really the combination of cost minus grants and scholarships, getting to what we refer to as the net price. That's what matters. So it's not how much the school costs, it's how much is that family going to have to pay, and that's after grants and scholarships.
And the way you find it is to go to most colleges' website, and even in the little search bar within their website, put in net price calculator to find it.
Yeah, usually it's on the financial aid page, but I think that most colleges' websites have up in the upper right-hand corner a search box, and just type in net price calculator, and that's the easiest way to find it.
Okay, well, we do have to take a break, and when we get back, we will get your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lincoln Health Wound Care Center in Booth Bay Harbor, offering a comprehensive approach to wound healing, 633-1600. And Mid-Maine Restoration, specializing in steeple and tower restoration throughout Maine and New Hampshire for over 25 years. Maine-steeplejacks.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Narconomics, how the business model of drug cartels compares to that of big box stores and fast food chains. We talk with journalist Tom Wainwright. He interviewed one gang leader who was running his operation from prison.
This guy had a great big tattoo going across his forehead, and he complained about managing his staff. He complained about competition with his rivals.
Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. There's a lot to listen to on Maine Public Radio, and we can't always hear exactly what we want. If news of Maine is what you seek, there is a solution. Each evening around 7, perhaps a little later, Barbara Caridi puts together This Day in Maine, a podcast with all of the day's Maine news, as reported by the MPBN Radio News team. You can listen to it or take it with you at mpbn.net. This Day in Maine, the day's news, all in one place, whenever you'd like.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about what to think about when thinking about college. With me in our Augusta studio today, Myla Tappan. She's College Access and Outreach Manager for the Finance Authority of Maine. Ann Richardson is Kent Hill Schools Director of College Counseling and past president of the New England Association for College Admission Counseling. Jared Cash is Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Maine, Farmington. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, I think there's something really important we need to talk about, that if your child is not a senior yet, there's some really significant changes coming in the next year. And I'm going to ask you about the changes in the SAT. And Myla, I'm going to ask you about the changes in the FAFSA. But why don't I start with you, Ann? My son took a three-part SAT, but my daughter, who's younger, is not going to have to, right?
That's correct. There is a new SAT that is debuting in March next month.
It is a redesigned SAT that is quite different from the old SAT. And juniors really need to be prepared for this new SAT.
So is it more than just taking away the writing section?
Well, they haven't taken away the writing section. There is still an essay. The essay section is now at the end of the SAT and is optional and is not counted as part of the score. We're going back to a 1600 score. But at the same time, if you go onto college websites, most of them are asking for the essay, for the students to take the essay. So it's not as optional as students might want to think. I think most colleges are going to be looking at the essay. The essay is different in that there is no longer a prompt. It is based on a reading and interpretation of a reading. That's very different. The math part of the SAT is very different. They are now including trigonometry in the math part, and there is also now a section where students will not be allowed to use a calculator, which is going to be a big change for the generation that has been brought up using calculators pretty much for all of their math. The reading and writing section is also different. One of the new pieces there is that there is going to be a document that they that students are going to need to read that is kind of a world conversation, global founding fathers kind of a piece that gives them a reading from a founding document of the United States or a commentary on it, a larger global conversation piece, and students are going to have to read that. And I think that it's probably fair to say that that's going to require a cultural context for students. They need to have taken some American history. They need to have a little bit of background. I think that's going to provide a challenge for the many international students taking the SAT. It is now a four-section SAT. It used to be 10 short sections. It's now four long sections. And it's going to be 5 minutes longer overall if you're taking the essay. It's a very short encapsulation of a significantly different test.
So as though that's not enough to absorb, we're going to turn to the FAFSA. And we've heard a little bit about we're going to be able to use prior tax returns. Talk about this, Myla. How is this a change?
The FAFSA has been available January 1st every year for as long as I've been in financial aid, which is a very long time at this point. Next year, it's going to be available on October 1st. So that's the big first change. But the second piece to that is if you have a senior this year and you're doing the FAFSA this year, you will find that they required you to provide 2015 tax year information. Well, in January, no one had their taxes done, so they were simply estimating that. That's always been the way that we do it. Then you have to go back in and you have to update and hope that you get your award letters early enough to make a May 1 decision. Next year, when the FAFSA becomes available on October 1st, we're again going to use 2015 tax year information. So what's really great about that is there's no need to estimate anymore. You'll be able to use the tool within the FAFSA called the IRS Data Retrieval Tool, and you'll be able to link to the IRS right when you're doing your FAFSA for the first time. You'll link to the IRS, retrieve your tax data, and transfer it back to the FAFSA.
And the philosophy behind the change is that most families' income does not change dramatically from year to year.
Right. It doesn't change dramatically, and there is a process in place, if it does change, for students and their families to go back to the financial aid offices to let them know about that change and they can deal with it. One of the big hopes that we have for this is that schools will indeed be able to get award letters out much sooner. I mean, if you think about the time that we take to make major purchases like to buy a home, you know, we're expecting sometimes students and families within a week or two to make these major decisions about financially as well as academically which schools are the best fit for student, it's really going to be beneficial if those students can have their award letters for at least a month or two to really contemplate what's going to be the best choice for them.
So if you're listening to this program right now and you have a high school junior, come October 1st, you're going to be able to fill out your FAFSA even before your child has the applications to the colleges in.
Absolutely.
And get that off your plate.
Right. Absolutely. And so that's a common question that we receive is, do I have to apply for admission first? Do I do financial aid first? Well, the reality is you just need to be doing them approximately at the same time. So students will now be doing their FAFSA, hopefully in October, November, the profile if they need to during that same period of time, and they'll be applying to college. All of those things ultimately need to come together. So the fall will be very busy, but that's going to give them a lot more opportunity to have good information, hopefully once they hit spring and make those decisions.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones now, and we're going to start with Bill calling from Portland. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been in college admissions for a long time.
Bill, let me interrupt you. If you're on a speakerphone, can you pick up the receiver?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I've been in the field of college admissions likewise for a long time, and it seems to me that I wholeheartedly concur with the need for families to get a handle on their FAFSA and their expected family contribution early in the process, but I would even back it up one step further in the way that families can really reduce stress around this, would be to see what reality, how the expected family contribution that's generated from the FAFSA really relates to the reality of their lives financially. People have lots of credit card debt that isn't counted in the form. Colleges have different financial aid packaging policies. And if the family can get a sense of what they actually can afford prior to going into the process, it allows them to shape the college search with college cost and affordability being at the center, as well as the other criteria that the student is using to choose colleges.
Yeah, Bill, thanks so much for your call. Do you recommend saying to the students, here's a number, and we need to not go above this number?
I absolutely recommend that parents and students have a conversation about college finances early on in the process, particularly if some schools are going to come off the table because of a family's ability to afford an education. It is an absolutely crucial conversation to have. You do not want a student to be excited about getting into a school and then to find out that that school is not affordable. So in that sense, I think it's important for parents and students to have that conversation early on. That's something that we always advise our parents and students to do, because otherwise there's heartbreak at the end of this process, and the students work so hard to get to the end of the process. You don't want heartbreak at the end.
Jared, I'm going to have you represent not just UMaine Farmington, but all of the UMaine schools. How affordable is the UMaine system for most students in Maine, and what does the system do to make it affordable for students who are lower middle income?
Sure. Well, this has been a major focus of the Chancellor's, the UMaine system, for quite a while. We just completed our fourth year of tuition freeze. We've had a 0% increase, no increase each year. You can add more years to that if you want to incorporate inflation into that. I think it's been five, or probably going on six, even if there was a modest increase. So keeping college affordable, we recognize that we needed to be sensitive to the incomes of Maine residents and where we stood as far as being a percentage of that per capita, as far as higher ed cost as a percentage of per capita income. I think we've done a tremendous job. On top of that, we are forced, and it's a good thing when you're in the world of student-centric. When you're into the world of student success, we are forced to be more competitive with one another, and I feel like we've done so on the financial aid front as well. There's 27 institutions of higher ed in Maine, if you count them all up. There's only 13,000 high school seniors in the state of Maine. There's only 7,100 or something around that number that go to college. We're all competing. I think the customer, the student in Maine, has really never been as empowered financially than, especially 10 years ago and before, when tuitions were going up 5, 8, 10% because the price last, the sensitivity was there. It was allowed by the student base. Anyways, so a lot of schools have enacted stronger merit programs. They've taken a look at their institutional aid for need. And they've certainly not fallen back, even with declining enrollments. They've usually kept those budgets steady, at the very least. And so these are all good moves. I mean, I want to go back to this prior year thing. There's nothing more that a college wants to do than to provide an acceptance letter along with the full picture financially. And it's been really challenging for students to get that full picture. And if you think about the math, usually the federal information comes down somewhere the first or second week of March. That sets all financial aid offices off for the races, and they start churning out, doing the hard calculations, churning out the paperwork so that the admitted students can receive their financial aid awards. Well, the deposit deadline nationally is May 1. So, you know, you're turning around financial aid information and asking someone to make an $80,000, if it's the public university main system, about an $80,000 four-year decision. If it's a school, $65,000, making a $250,000 decision within a month's time. So there are definitely ways to estimate, but to get that concrete kind of this is what I'll owe come July, I think this is a great move and it's certainly welcome from the higher ed side of the desk.
Myla, I know it's one of the core missions of FAME, the Finance Authority of Maine, to make college affordable for Maine kids from every corner of the state. What does FAME do to make it possible?
Well, one of the things that we do, first of all, is that we help families to save for college. And so as we started at the beginning, saving is such a huge piece of the puzzle. And so a lot of people are already familiar with the fact that in Maine, we're very fortunate to have the Elfon grant, the $500 grant from the Elfon Foundation. So every student in Maine has a great start on saving for college. But in Maine, we also have something called the Next Gen program that we administer at FAME. And that's a 529 program, a tax-advantaged college savings program. 529 comes from, if you actually looked up in the IRS regulations, not that you would want to, in Section 529, you'd see these plans discussed. So families can save by putting in after-tax dollars. Hopefully that money grows over a period of time, and they don't have to pay taxes on it if they use it for higher education. What we have in Maine to help families save is that we have an initial matching grant for those families that didn't receive the Elfon grant. So those of us who have kids that are older that the Elfon grant wasn't around, any of our children, as long as either we're a Maine resident or our child is, we can open up an account and put in $25 and get a $200 initial matching grant. Then on top of that, we have a Next Step matching grant. And what that allows families to do is have every dollar that they put in matched at 50 cents on the dollar, up to a total of $300 in grant funds per year, each and every year. And then on top of that, we have an automated funding account. How many of us have set up automated payments? And once you get them set up, you keep contributing. And so once families set that up, after six of those payments, they get another $100 grant. So first of all, there's really great money available. And we want families to start saving early because not only is it beneficial financially, but we've also found that it's beneficial aspirationally. You know, families who save, those students are almost seven times more likely to go to college. How powerful is it when these students see, oh my goodness, my family believes in me going to college so much that they're putting money aside. So, and grandparents can absolutely contribute to these and other family members as well. So that's one of the primary things we do at FAME. Beyond that, we're there to help families through the process. So we will start in March doing our financial aid nights for those juniors. So visit your high schools, check out their calendar, ask them when they're having a financial aid night. We'll be there. We'll be out in force talking about this process in more detail. And we have a great website and all sorts of information available just to support families as they go through this process. It can sometimes be confusing, but it doesn't need to be. There are those of us who have been through it. We've worked our whole lives in this, and we want to be there free of charge to help families get through this and understand what they need to do.
All right. Well, on that note, we do have to take another break, but if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566.
You make Maine calling possible, as does Revision Energy, partnering with Pika Energy to deliver clean solar power storage. Learn more at revisionenergy.com/pika.
Mad Max Fury Road is unusual for being an action movie with 10 Oscar nominations and for being a car chase film with a female editor. Margaret Sixel focused on more than just the explosions.
I really had to feel that there was an emotional content to a lot of the stunts.
How an editor shapes a movie on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 this afternoon to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate, are lifespans already long enough?
If you ask me, do I want to have cancer at 75 or do I want to be bored at 110, I know which one I'm going to take.
Who do you think is going to be the people living the longest? It's going to be the billionaires.
That's all coming up on Intelligence Squared US.
And that's coming up in just a few minutes at 1 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, looking at college admissions and finances. In our studio with me, we're here in Augusta, Jared Cash, Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Maine Farmington, Myla Tappan, College Access and Outreach Manager for the Finance Authority of Maine, Ann Richardson. She's the Director of College Counseling for Kent Hill School, and was past president of the New England Association for College Admission Counseling. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Jean. She says, what if your high school student has decided to take a gap year? Should they still apply to colleges, make a decision, and then defer? Do they still get to have any scholarships, grants, et cetera, deferred? For some young people, a gap year helps them to decide on a career, but can have financial implications for paying for college. Your suggestions will be much appreciated. And Anne, before I throw this to you, I want to just mention that we had a great guest about a year ago on Maine Calling, Genevieve Morgan, who has written a book about this very subject. And I'm drawing a blank. Can you think of the name of it off the top of your head? We'll put it on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. But there's so many more options for students than you might imagine. There's college, there's gap years, there's all sorts of options for kids.
There really are. And certainly I think that a gap year can be enormously beneficial for students. Many colleges are happy to look at applications from students who have taken gap years. I know at Kent's Hill we have a postgraduate program for students who are contemplating, who are taking a gap year and working to get their SAT scores up or to take a few more courses. There are lots and lots of options, and it's not a bad thing. I would say that we always counsel any student who is thinking of a gap year to apply to college and defer at least they can defer at one college. And often it's just a matter of reactivating the application or just taking the deferral away and re-upping.
And I just remember Genevieve Morgan's book is called Undecided. But anyway, but gap years are far more popular than they used to be.
Well, it's always been popular in Europe. The Europeans and many of the Commonwealth countries, it is an expected thing to do to take a gap year. And it is just beginning to catch on, I think, in the United States. I think parents are much more amenable to students taking some time to find out what they really want to do and whether they really do want to spend that money to go to college and take great advantage of what is offered at a college. And so I think that gap years have become a popular option and a very good option for students, too.
Jared, how do colleges view kids who get in and then defer for a year?
I agree completely with what Anne said. We welcome gap year applicants. I would I agree also that the route of, in most cases, I'd say the route of applying first and then deferring is a really good way to go, because a lot of times the colleges are set up in their admissions processes to kind of analyze a student based off their high school's class graduation. And so when they become a class removed, it creates a little more complexity. It's nothing a college enrollment office can't handle. But the deferral is a great way to go. As far as the colleges and universities are concerned, when students go out there and immerse themselves a little bit more broadly than being full-time in K-12 education has allowed them to be, we often find they bring in a maturity, a sense of perspective into the classroom, that it's only a gain for us. Now, that being said, I guess the only time when I've said a gap year is not a good idea is when there's the lack of structure. So it's not a time to be, letting son or daughter sleep on the couch and look for things to do in town. I mean, there needs to be some structure. There needs to be some intellectual stimulation that can take several forms. Ideally, maybe a little global exposure or some travel. There's many, many ways you can do it through programs, but you can also construct your own very fruitful gap year.
All right. And we have an email here from Elizabeth and Myla. I think this one is going to go to you. Elizabeth writes, I'm wondering about the new, I'm reading the wrong one here. This one is for Martha. My screen updated in between when I looked at it before. Perhaps it has changed, but listening just before the break, it seems that It seems not that private schools are need blind, that they do look at savings and deduct from that for grants and aid. My daughter had a small trust fund, and the college she went to gave her a nice financial aid package, but they also took one-third of her trust each year. Assets were definitely included when calculating tuition grants. When I took a second job to help with the remaining tuition, they simply reduced the grant amount by my increase in income. How discouraging is that?
Well, that is not typical of what we see. So, you know, what's hard sometimes, I think, with families, and I'm not saying this is the case with this family, but sometimes families don't get all the financial aid that they think they need, and they think it's because they have saved, when in reality, schools just don't always have enough aid to give people. And when people haven't saved, not only do they not have enough aid coming from the school, they don't have any options available to help them pay for school. So when it comes to the FAFSA, it definitely is a case where I can tell you 100%, they never take more, you know, than a certain percentage. They, you know, a third is not what the FAFSA would take into account.
So that's not what this emailer is talking about is not a federal grant then. This is probably a private school.
It's probably a private school. And one of the things I would say, too, is it does matter how families save. So when we talk about, you know, NextGen or 529s, it's always better when the savings is in the parent's name, not the student's name. Students who have trusts can find that there is an impact on their financial aid eligibility that would be greater than if the family had saved in any other way. So it's always better for savings to be in the parents' names. 529s are automatically in the parents' name, and they wouldn't have experienced, I don't think, that same impact. You know, schools with their own money can do what they want. But when it comes to the federal rules, we're very sure, you know, that savings doesn't have that sort of negative impact.
So I'm guessing people really have to have their eyes open then, Jared. If we're going to apply to a private school and they're giving us this grant money, that may not be set in stone for those 4 years or 5 years.
That's something to be highly cautious of. I mean, there is a phenomenon of front loading that's out there. When I think about front loading, I'm thinking of schools who are climbing the ladder, preferential packaging their financial aid awards to try to build a higher academic profile in their class. It tends to be private schools that are respected, but still maybe not the top tier schools in the country. And so they put their chips, if you will, both on the front end of financial aid packages and also for their top academic admits in the pool. And, you know, there's merit aid at public universities as well. But it's just, it's a wise question to ask or to screen your scholarship awards that come this time of year. They're nice little plate warmers in the mail for folks who have been admitted to see, is this a scholarship that runs, is it renewable 4 years through a 6 year period? Or is it a one-time first-year monies? And it's really hard sometimes. This is where parents do need to be involved. It's really hard for a 17-year-old sometimes when they have their heart set on a college to not get over the fact that someone's given them some sort of $10,000 or $20,000, maybe even $30,000 presidential scholarship. But look at the fine print.
And I would say that college counselors need to be aware of this as well, and they need to know what schools have a reputation for doing this. Certainly that's something that we keep track of in our office at Kent Hill, and we are very careful with parents and students to make sure that they understand the fine print. Even the award letter can be very, very confusing, and so we really like to help parents go through the award letter and see just exactly what is being offered when, what's a loan, what's a grant. Is health insurance included in the award letter or not? All those kinds of, there are some real pitfalls that we need to be aware of.
So if you have any questions, go directly to your high school's college counselor before you sign anything.
Absolutely. And it, certainly when we don't know the answer, the people that we go to are the fame.
Okay. We're going to go. Let's see. We've got a call from West Baldwin and Michelle. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Yes, great program. I have a two-part question. One is, we have a high insurance deductible of $10,000 over the past 5 years. We have accrued a $5,000 medical debt just through having a family of four. So is there, number one, is there any place in this to be taken taken into account by the institution, the aid institution? And my second question if you did get into some place, like my daughter wants WPI, if she commits, will they then open up more aid, awarding more aid for her?
All right, Myla?
Well, I think one of the things to always keep in mind is when you fill out the FAFSA or any other financial aid forms, that is all the school knows about you. So families should feel very comfortable going back to the financial aid office and saying, hey, look, I've got this going on. We have this, you know, significant debt because of medical expenses. Schools want to know about that information, particularly if it's something that the family didn't have a lot of control over. So always go back, and what schools will often require at that point is they just want some documentation. They just want to understand the full picture for the family. But where schools can help, they will help. They want to be there to assist those families. As far as more aid, you know, one of the challenges with colleges is that every college is a little bit different. I worked at UMaine for 16 years. Even how we did things over the course of 16 years changed. Sometimes there was more money available, sometimes there was less. But what I would say is it's great to make a friend in the financial aid office, get to know somebody, call with your questions, make that connection so that every time you call, you don't have to repeat your story. They're familiar with you. And what you may find is that over time, if money opens up, I used to keep a list of students who, if any additional money became available, I would think, hey, I'm going to reach out to this person. This would be someone who would qualify for this.
All right. Michelle, thanks for your question. We're going to move on to Nobleboro. And Tom, hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello. Is there an advantage or a disadvantage to a grandparent setting up a 529 plan?
Great question. Yeah.
Our preference is that the 529 be in the parent's name, and we certainly think it's wonderful to have grandparents contribute to that. And the reason that we recommend that is when the 529 is in the parent's name, it's counted as a parent asset. And again, oftentimes not taken into account at all, or if it is taken into account, has very, very little impact. If it's in a grandparent's name, what's supposed to happen is when those funds come out, the next year when the student applies for financial aid, they are supposed to list that money that was given to them by the grandparents on the next year's financial aid application. So our preference is to have it in the parent's name, grandparents contributing, fabulous. But if grandparents have already set up one and want to have one, what we recommend is they hold that until the end. So maybe they save it until senior year when the student isn't going to have to file it FAFSA the next year after that, so it won't be showing up any longer.
Senior year in college.
Senior year in college, yes, yes. Thank you for clarifying that, yes.
Okay, great. We have an email from Diana. She writes, I'm surprised how many high school students aren't aware that their of their family's financial realities, sometimes because the parents are sharing them. I wonder if she's saying sometimes because parents aren't sharing them. Anyway, I'm a big advocate of all family members appropriately involved in financial matters. Parents of college applicants should be aware that the colleges address all their correspondence to the student, and everything's worded as if the student is filling it out, including supplying the parents' tax information. You may have to be proactive to be included in email correspondence. The process requires students to be fully involved. And that was a surprise to me.
Well, the emailer is absolutely correct. All the correspondence does start going to the student. The grades will be reported to the students, and unless the students allow parents to have access to that kind of information, you can go through 4 years of college without telling your parents your grades, if that is indeed the case. Again, I think this goes back to two things that are very important in the process, and something that we really emphasize at Kent's Hill is one, parents and students have to have that financial conversation early on to figure out what is going to be affordable. And second, and this is something that is at times hard for parents, we truly believe that the students have to own the process. They have to be the drivers in this process. They have to be the ones filling out the forms. They have to be the ones initiating phone calls and emails to the offices. There are some stories out there that some horror stories out there about students that have really not been empowered to do this and have people who are doing everything for them, and that is just not what you want.
So you advocate the student filling out the FAFSA and the CSS?
I advocate students filling out their own application forms, and I advocate for students sitting with their parents and filling out the FAFSA and profile with their parents and understanding the process. They may not be able to fill out every question on the FAFSA, but as the emailer correctly pointed out, everything is geared to as if the student is filling out this form.
I absolutely agree that it's a partnership between the student and the parents. The first half of the FAFSA, the student actually can fill out. It's all demographic information. It's about where they went to high school, where they're looking to go to college. You know, once they get further into it, yes, they absolutely are going to need parent information. And the other thing I think is that communication piece. So many schools are communicating electronically. So not only is it going to the student, but it's going to the student sometimes in an email so that it's not even coming in the mailbox and parents aren't even seeing that something has arrived. So it's really important that families have that conversation about how they're going to communicate.
Again, really different than it used to be. We're out of time. Thank you all for joining us today. Ann Richardson, Kent Hill Schools Director of College Counseling and past president of the New England Association for College Admission Counseling. Myla Tappan is College Access and Outreach Manager for the Finance Authority of Maine. Jared Cash is Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Maine, Farmington. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and we had additional help from A.J. Higgins in our Augusta studio. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, you know him best as Carson from Downton Abbey, but actor Jim Carter has a long and award-winning career as an actor. He joins host Keith Shortall to talk about the final season of Downton Abbey and his work to help raise money for the people of Nepal who are still recovering from last year's devastating earthquake there. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.